An appalling and apparently senseless crime. Two apparently heartless young criminals. What is the reality behind the appearance?
There's no time.
Okay, it's episode 85.
85? This is like a Norse saga or some shit like that. Damn.
Sit back and we will tell you the tale of... I felt like I was the narrator of Conan the Barbarian there for a second. Hopefully this sounds better. We actually are moving the microphone around to different areas.
Trying to get up a new studio arrangement.
To try to get the best arrangement for the best sound possible. The problem is that, you know, my office is kind of small and... I have two computers, and the computer that I record on is different than, I mean, it's kind of like...
The one she keeps her notes on.
Than the one I keep my notes on, and it's kind of like in a different position. So whenever I have the microphone so we can both talk into it, I usually have to turn my head to look at my notes, which means, you know...
But and I'm trying to position the microphone in between us so one of us isn't louder than the other. A lot of times I'm louder than she
is. Yeah, because you're always yelling.
Yeah. Well, I project more, talk like a man, you know what I'm talking about. Talking from the diaphragm, you know.
Hey, I took singing lessons too. Okay. I know. But anyway, I just don't like to shout into the
microphone. I'm not shouting, though. That's just testosterone coursing through my body. It just makes that shit happen. Like that. Okay. Man, I drop his nuts.
Okay, I understand. Yeah, okay. So there the nuts drop
right
there.
The nuts right here, man. You know all about it. Leave him alone, Jenny. Get off of him. Get off of him.
All right, I'm sorry. I talked about your nuts.
Yeah, it's okay.
Okay.
I know.
All right. So I know I am.
The hosts are a couple. That shit's going to go down sometimes.
It does happen sometimes. I'm sorry about that.
It's just hormones.
You know what's very funny? And I know I'm going off on a tangent, but it's very funny because I remember someone commenting. I think I deleted it because I delete negative YouTube comments.
Well, if you say stupid shit.
If you just say stupid shit, I'm just like, bye. Yeah. You know, I don't answer. I don't again because why?
Right. We police our comment section. This is not going to be a ghetto down in there with a bunch of assholes. Certain channels will do that. And then the show just starts to degenerate. And you don't, and then you can't get guests.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to be.
I remember someone making a comment that. Well, they said that the comment was that you just sounded like you wanted to get in my pants. I'm like, yeah.
Oh, I've been there. I planted that flag. All right.
Oh,
we're
the,
basically
the
married.
Mental image.
We're basically married.
We have been together very long.
We've been
long
together
time.
How long?
Almost 7 years.
Almost 7 years,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And living together most of that time.
Yeah.
Actually, yeah.
Yeah, we've been together, living together almost 6.5 years, I want to say. Something like that. 6.5, something like
that. Yeah, so, dude, man, stop hating. I got this shit wrapped up over here, man. All
right. Right? But I did delete that.
Jenny and I are kind of like creations of each other. A lot of the cool shit that's happened for us over the past 7 years is the influence of one of us upon the other.
Yeah.
So in a way, it's kind of like two of us equal more than the sum of the parts type of deal, you know. It's, Spock would understand. It's like Vulcans. Vulcan shit happening. You know? We kind of like push each other to greater heights all the time.
Yeah, you know? Definitely.
Yeah. So I'm kind of like her manager.
Yeah.
In a way. But she also keeps me in check.
Yeah.
But it's easier.
Well, you know, I'm not very good at that, though.
A person. Yeah, that's true. Writers or a person that creates things sometimes can't see it objectively, so they'll over criticize something or they're too lax on something. I kind of help her to select what book she should write next, you know, that kind of stuff, moving her into audiobooks and trying to figure out how to get that done right. Over time, I just hope that the way this is going to go down is Jenny's catalog will expand, the quality will get better. We even plan on going back and actually re-releasing audiobooks with better audio.
But yeah, when we have better audio equipment.
But all that's going to take time because, you have to grow and perfect at the same time, and these new books have to come out in to complete that trilogy.
Yeah.
So that's...
Because I definitely want to have that Faceless Villain trilogy done this year.
Right. And we can always go back and clean up certain things that weren't done to spec. And we got to get your fiction out on audiobook,
too. Yeah, I really need to get to that. I haven't got around to it yet.
Because that will unlock another four books that were already written. Yeah. So once we get the audio down... And once you have the time and the trilogy's done, we'll go back and we'll get your fiction out.
Yeah, I definitely want to do that.
Yeah, but fiction, you know, fiction is always harder to sell than
nonfiction. It's a harder sell than nonfiction, yeah.
And if you have a strong backbone and workmanly nonfiction, then you can sell fiction.
Yeah.
I think.
Because, you know, I personally think my fiction's pretty good. I mean,
like I think
you said,
it's good.
I'm very overcritical of my own. I guess most creative people are. Right. But... I try to write stuff and then like months later I'll read it and be like, hey, that doesn't suck. All right.
And you're older and wiser now, so coming fiction will actually be better than your older fiction.
I think so too, because I think I've gotten a lot more, a lot less bullshit. I cut out a lot of bullshit because I think I tended to over make everything flowery and stuff, like very Anne Ricey back in the old days.
Right.
But I've kind of cut a lot of that out by now.
Yeah, but let's get to the news.
Since we're talking about Faceless Villain, though, I do definitely want to give that a shout out. I am still working on volume 2. Like I said, I just finished chapter 9. It has about 18 chapters, so I'm about halfway done. Should be done in a couple of months. I'm really working hard on it. And actually, one of the murder cases that we're going to be talking about today was in the first volume. It was like the last case we discussed. Okay. And I definitely want to discuss it because it ties in with the whole In Cold Blood thing we're talking about today. Mm-hmm. I also want to mention our last movie review, which was Roman Polanski's The Tenant, which is one of the creepiest movies ever. But yeah, Roman Polanski's a piece of shit, but his movies are actually really good.
Yeah, he knows what he's doing.
The Tenant is actually one of the best surreal horror films ever. It's just very unsettling, the whole vibe of it.
And if you're listening to this show and you did not listen to our Tenant review, go back and listen to that. It's a movie you can watch for free, on YouTube.
Yeah, I think someone put it on YouTube.
It's an awesome movie. It's every bit as good as The Shining. It's just a different...
And honestly, I'm going to say, like I said, I actually like The Tenant a little bit better than Rosemary's Baby. It's a different kind of movie, but it's creepier for sure,
I think. Creepy flick. Our friend Shada had never seen it. She saw it. She goes, man, it was awesome.
Yeah. Also, I want to give a particular shout out. Oh, I'm going to say, check out our Patreon at patreon.com/13o'clock, as I always say. If you don't like Patreon and you want to support the show with a one-time donation, you can go to our blog, which is 13o'clockpodcast.wordpress.com, and there's a link in the sidebar to a PayPal account. Want to give a special shout out to Lana, I hope I'm pronouncing it right. She had actually given us money through PayPal before.
Yeah.
But now she signed up as a regular patron.
Yeah, you told me
on our Patreon. Right. So hooray, thank you very much.
Yeah, we have several contributors that go to us directly through PayPal. We really want to thank those folks because several of them are heavy hitters. I mean, they'll drop $50 on us.
Yeah.
You know, that,
which that is way, way appreciated. Yeah. Especially since it's tax season and I owe it a bunch.
Got to pay it off.
Being self-employed is, got to spend a lot of money. Okay.
Spend money. Right.
So before we get to, like I said, our show today, we're going to be talking about probably one of the most famous true crime cases in American history, the Clutter family murders, which was obviously the subject of Truman Capote's classic In Cold Blood. But I also want to talk about another family massacre that happened only about a month later. And kind of current thinking is that maybe the same two guys that did the Clutter murders might have done this one too. I kind of am leaning toward that. So I kind of want to discuss both of those things. And actually, I read In Cold Blood a long time ago. I've seen the movie, which was horrifying. So this is one I've been wanting to do for a while. And I definitely wanted to talk about the Walkers too, because I feel like they kind of get short shrift. Mm-hmm. It's not that the Clutter family murder wasn't horrific. It's just that it's so well remembered because of the book.
Right.
And I want to talk a little bit about the book too, and about Truman Capote and stuff like that. But before we get into that, I have a couple of news stories. I actually got these couple. These don't have anything to do with true crime really, but I just thought these were amusing. And I said, well, I'll just pick kind of funny / gross ones because the rest of the content of the show is so depressing. So I just got these from like the News of the Weird site or whatever from last week. Now, this first one took place in Romania, And it deals with this guy named Constantine Relieu, I think is how you pronounce. He's a 63-year-old man. Now, evidently, back in the 90s or early 90s, 1992, he left Romania to go to Turkey to find a job. Well, weirdly, he did not tell his wife that he was he just took off, I guess.
Yeah, that sounds fishy.
And so his wife, after 10 years had passed, and she never heard from him.
Yeah.
So she had him pronounced dead.
Yeah, there had to have been a woman
involved. As you do.
Had there been a woman
involved. That's what I mean. Why would you do that without, like, saying, hey, I'm just over here looking for a job? You know, it seems very weird. So evidently, so she hadn't heard from him from all that time. So she had him pronounced dead, you know, so they
could
probate his will and stuff like that, you know, because, you know, what are you going to do?
That's just how it's going
to go. So she goes to court in 2003, and she argued in court to get a death certificate. So she got it. And then Constantine is in Turkey, and then his papers expired. So he got shipped back to Romania, and he gets back there, and the immigration says, dude,
you're dead.
And the guy's like, no, I'm not dead. I'm right here. And so he had to go to court and appeal the death certificate. He's like, no, I'm right here. I'm alive. And the funniest thing is the court said, no.
Nope, you're dead.
You're dead. We can't repeal it. This death certificate, it is a final thing. So it's like, what is this dude going to do now? I'm intrigued.
Perfect example of the living dead.
That's what there I mean. And actually, the pictures that I already picked out to go in the video are all like from Night of the Living Dead, like zombies and
That's
shit.
That's hilarious.
Plus a couple of Vlad the Impaler pictures and, you know, Dracula and stuff. He's like the living dead. So yeah, his quote was, I am officially dead, although I'm alive.
Yeah.
So what's he going to do, like, when he tries to go? I mean, I guess he's probably, like, retirement age now. But, you know, when he goes to find another job, like, there's a dead guy, like,
He could probably always change his name.
That's, I'm thinking he'll probably have to do that. But that's just hilarious to me that a court can go, nope, you're dead, sorry. Yeah, even though you're standing right there. Here was the other story, and I apologize for this one because this is pretty disgusting. And I
Well, then it's definitely supposed to be on the show.
This would be really, like, I feel bad laughing about it because I would be horrified if this happened to me. This happened in Ravenna, Ohio, and there's this woman named Nicolette Botsford, and she's driving at night in with her mom in a car.
Okay.
And she's eating cashews out of a planter's, you know, little can. And she pops one in her mouth, and she's like, wow, that's awfully hard for a cashew.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
She takes it out. Her mom turns on the overhead light in the car, and it's a human tooth.
Oh.
And it's all covered with blood.
Oh, covered with blood. It was packed in there, huh? I know. It was
like
packed in there.
Yeah. And so she says, obviously, as you would, she barfed a whole bunch of times.
Yeah.
She had to be taken to the hospital. They had to treat her just in case. You know, they don't know what diseases that person has.
I think those come from Africa, don't they?
I'm not sure where they pack those. It doesn't really say. They said,
I can picture a couple of African guys working on a big old pile of peanuts drying out, punching each other, and one of them knocks another one's tooth out, and they can't find it.
That's how I picture. What if that happened?
Yeah.
Yeah, so planters mix nuts. Apparently, they're mixed with human teeth. And fucking gross, man. But apparently,
my mom knew a guy when she was a kid in high school who she was dating the guy who worked at one of the bird eye. I think it was bird eye.
Frozen vegetables.
Right. He was working on some kind of a pea picking machine, driving it. I don't remember exactly how it was. And he fell off of it, and his foot got caught into something, and it knocked two of his toes off.
Oh no!
And it went into the peas. They couldn't find it, and it got packed into those peas.
Well, yeah, I'm sure stuff like that happens all the time.
Somebody got that dude's. I don't know if it was out in the field or if it was in the packing plant. I think, now that I think about it, because, you know, I didn't prepare for this. I think it was in the packing plant.
Yeah.
The toes went into the peas and got frozen. They couldn't find them.
Well, yeah. How are you going to find two little toes in, like, tons and tons of peas?
And that was back, like, in the late 50s. In the late 50s, maybe.
I was going to say.
That would have been in the 60s, probably mid-60s when that happened.
I was going to say, if it had been later, maybe I got them, and that's why I hated peas for so long. So I found somebody's toes in there.
Imagine somebody, you remember they used to come in those square boxes, and they're wrapped, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I remember those.
Yeah, they throw that into the boiling water,
and
then there's some toes float up to the top. Damn.
Extra protein.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
But I never heard anything about it.
I'm surprised that it doesn't happen more often.
Never heard anything about it.
I mean, now I guess it happens less now because so many things are automated.
Right.
But I, you know, back in the old days when people used to have to work in the factories, I mean, I'm sure you'd probably get your finger fucking caught in the thing all the time and shit like that and get cut off. Holy crap.
Yeah.
But yeah, so they've contacted Planters and Planters is investigating, you know, where it was packed and how that got in there and stuff like that. But, you know, fucking gross.
Yeah.
Anyway, all right. So now let's get on to the main topic of the show. And the first thing I want to talk about is the infamous murder of the Clutter family. Mm-hmm. This happened in 1959 in Kansas. And this family, actually quite prosperous. It was Herb Clutter was the dad. Bonnie Mae was the mom. They had two teenagers still living at home. Kenyon was 15 and Nancy was 16. They also had two older daughters who were named Beverly and Ivana.
Ivana.
No, it's Eve Anna. Really? E-V-E-A-N-N-A.
It's two separate words.
No, it's one word.
One? Really?
Yeah, but they spelled it like that. Yeah, I know. Weird. I was like, that's kind of a cool name.
Yeah.
But they had already, they actually were not murdered. They are the surviving family members because they had already grown up and moved away. One was in college and one had married and lived in another state.
All right.
So this was a very well-liked family. They had about 3,000 acres, kind of a small town, only about 70 houses, only about 150 people. They lived in a really nice brick house at the end of this dirt road. Okay, so this happens on, it's November 14th, which was a Saturday. Now, Herb had spent his day with, he had like a little office attached to the house. And he had spent his day with an insurance salesman. He'd actually been kind of hemming and hawing about, oh, maybe I'll buy a life insurance policy or something like that. So he'd been talking to the insurance agent all day. He finally decided, you know, I'm going to go ahead and purchase the life insurance policy. So he filled out the forms. He gave the guy the check, whatever. Now, later that night, Nancy had a boyfriend named Bob Rupp. And he was over at their house watching TV with the family. And he left about 11 p.m. There was a farmhand who also lived on the property. And he lived, he had a house, but it was like out behind the barn. And about a football field length away. And he actually saw and heard the boyfriend leave. Now, at some point after that, the entire family was murdered. They didn't find them until the next morning. Here's the creepy thing. The next morning, some of their, which was a Sunday, some of the farmhands came and they milked the cows and stuff like that. And they, and actually, if you, there's a lot of documentaries about this and a lot of, there was actually a really good one. It was four parts that came out. It was on Sundance and it's called Cold Blooded. And there's a lot of interviews with surviving family members and, you know, investigators who are still alive who worked on the case and stuff. So one of the farmhands, he's like, okay, we came and milked the cows like we always did. And we just took the milk into the house. He's like, the house is never locked. It was Kansas. Right. You know, it's a small town. Everybody knew each other. Nobody locked their doors. So he's like, we went into the house and put the milk in the house and then they left.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so, and they didn't see anything.
They didn't see anything.
Right. Which to me, that creeps me out. That would creep me out because everybody was dead in there.
Yeah, you walk into it like a tomb and you don't even
know. Yeah, you don't even know. So the bodies weren't discovered until a couple hours later. It's probably about 11 in the morning. Apparently, the Clutter family was in the habit of taking one of Nancy's friends to church with them, like giving them a ride. So this girl's dad would drop her off at the Clutter house on Sunday morning. So this girl goes up to the house and knocks on all the doors and stuff like that, and nobody's answering. And she's like, and the house is dark and stuff like that, which is weird because it's like, you know, normally they're always ready for church. They don't oversleep. Right. Or anything like, you know, it's a farm family. Right, they have to get up and do chores and shit.
Right.
So she thinks it's weird. So she goes back to her dad's car and she's like, okay, well, no one's answering. And that's really strange. So he says, okay, well, what we'll do is we'll drive to Nancy's other friend's house who they also usually, the Clutters usually also gave a ride to. And she's like, maybe she knows what's going on. Maybe they got called out of town or something like that. So they go to this other girl's house and she's like, I don't know. It's, you know, I don't know what's going on. So the dad takes the two girls back to the Clutter house. Mm. Now the two girls go in the house. Mm. These are like 16, 17 year old girls. They see nobody. All the lights are out and everything like that. They go upstairs to Nancy's room and they see her in her bed. At first they thought she was still asleep, but then they see blood all over the wall.
Right.
And then they go downstairs. They see that the phone line has been cut. They flip out. They go back to the dad. They call the police and everything like that. Now the police come in. They find Herb Clutter, the dad.
Mm-hmm.
He is down in the cellar in the furnace room. His throat has been cut.
Mm-hmm.
He has been shot in the side or the front of the head. So, you know, basically with a shotgun. He's also been bound and gagged. Also in the cellar, in the rec room, which, because it was a big cellar with several rooms, was the 15-year-old Kenyon. He had also been bound and gagged and shot in the head. Upstairs in the two bedrooms, they found the mom, Bonnie Mae, in her bedroom, also bound and gagged, shot in the head. Nancy, the 16-year-old girl, in her room, bound but not gagged, shot in the back of the head.
Not raped.
No, but I'll get into that a little bit later. So, obviously, this is a very small town. Nothing like this has ever happened before. They have no idea.
What year was this again?
1959.
Okay.
Who would want to kill this family? I mean, the Clutters, like I said, and if you listen to interviews with the investigators and people who lived in the town, there's like, really, you could find no one that had a bad thing to say about any of the family.
It's a one-story house?
Two stories.
Wow.
With a cellar.
Wow. That means that there's places to run and hide, which leads me to believe that this may have been done by more than one person, because it's hard to control a lot of people on multiple floors. Okay.
They know who did it? Yeah.
Okay. It was one person?
No, it's two people.
That's what I thought. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, this is a very famous story. I don't really know this case.
I'm just riding along this.
It was two people.
Yeah.
So at first, they're just like, who would do this?
Okay.
Now, at first, they're operating under the assumption, okay, well, this was a brutal crime. This must have been somebody who had a grudge against the family, although they were finding it difficult to find anybody that had that, because like I said, these were very well-liked. Right. You know, they were very active in the community, active in the church, everything like that, very well-liked. And also, they were like, well, it didn't really seem to be robbery, because nothing was really taken. Now, both the women's purses had been rifled through, but really only a few dollars was taken. They only two things that were taken from the house were a small transistor radio, which was taken from the 15-year-old's bedroom, and a pair of binoculars. And the weird thing was that there were other valuable things, like, for example, Mrs. Clutter's wedding ring, which was a diamond and it was quite large, was still there, and her jewelry and things like that. Nothing was taken. So they said, well, obviously this is someone with a personal beef against this family. So that kind of, you know, their investigations started along that track. Now,
I'm already suspecting that that's not the case based on what you told me so
well, like, far. I said, it's actually funny because, like I said, this is probably the best known true crime. I mean, Truman Capote's In Cold Blood is the second best-selling true crime book ever, after Helter Skelter.
I don't know anything about this case. Can I tell you what I think just based on what you told me so far?
If you want.
Okay, this is what I think. This sounds like two loser novice burglar slash criminals that wanted to steal some shit, and they thought there was a bunch of money in there, and they went through this whole heist and found out that there was nothing there and just killed those people for nothing.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened.
Really?
Yeah.
You're not fucking with me. That's really what it is.
Are you sure you don't know the story?
Not really. I don't know the story.
All right. So, but like I said, at first, the investigation proceeded along the lines that this must have been someone with a grudge against the family, because what else would you think?
Right.
Because it didn't look like a robbery.
Right.
So at first, they're kind of questioning. Now, first, they questioned Bob Rupp, the boyfriend, because he did admit, hey, I was at the house that night, though he did leave.
She wasn't raped, so I immediately know that there's no sexual motive. Yeah,
but I'm going to get into that a little bit
later. There's more to it than that?
Yeah, more to it than that.
Okay.
There was some kind of rumors that Bob Rupp, it's like, well, maybe he would have had a motive because evidently Nancy's parents didn't want them to be... They didn't so much disapprove of him as they didn't want them to be dating exclusively, mainly because he was a Catholic and they were Methodist. So it was a religion thing, you know, back in those days, that was kind of a big deal. But they didn't forbid them from seeing each other, obviously, because he was over there watching TV with the family. You know, he liked the family and everything like that. Police also thought it was significant that three family members had been bound and gagged and shot in the front or the side of the head so that they would have been looking at their killers when they were shot. And Nancy was not gagged and was shot in the back of the head, almost as though someone cared about her or couldn't look her in the face.
Weird.
So that was kind of...
But I can't look at you.
Right.
This isn't personal.
That's kind of what they were thinking. So that's kind of why he sort of came up as a suspect. But, you know, the more they looked into it, they're like, obviously it wasn't him. You know, he had left. It's like he didn't really have any reason. They weren't preventing him from seeing her or anything like that. There was also another guy who apparently had some business dealings with Herb and had tried to rip him off and had come onto Herb's property, and Herb had run him off with a, you know, like shaved a gun at him. It's like, hey, get off of my property or whatever. Right. So they questioned that guy, but that guy was in another state. So they were kind of going in that direction. But then a couple of days after the murders, They get a tip. There's this fella who is an inmate in prison. His name is Floyd Wells. And he at first didn't want to. He heard on the radio what had happened at the Clutter Farm. And at first he didn't want to say anything to the warden because, you know, he didn't want to be seen as a snitch or anything right. like that. So he kind of had this thing where he's like, he told this other guy, hey, go tell the warden that I want to see him. So it looks like the warden's calling me in there like I'm in trouble. You know what I mean? So it doesn't look like I'm narking someone out. So he goes in there and he says that about a decade before he had worked for Herb Clutter as a farmhand. And for some reason, he misremembered that Herb Clutter had a safe in his office that had $10,000 in it. Floyd Wells worked on the farm when the Clutter family was building the house. Right. So Herb Clutter was putting out a lot of money, you know, into builders and contractors and stuff right. like that. So for some reason, Floyd remembered that he had a safe in his office and there was all this money in it.
Yeah, but that was back during construction.
Yeah. Right? And yeah. Well, and the thing is, Herb had never had a safe in okay. his office. Right. And honestly, everyone who knew him and had business dealings with him said he never paid in cash. It was right. always a check. He did not have cash in the house. Everybody knew that about him. Okay, so Floyd Wells was a former cellmate of a man named Richard Dick Hickok.
All right.
And Floyd Wells tells the police, you know, I told Hickok about this farm, about the Clutter family, about how I worked for them, about how that farmer had this big safe at his house with all this money in it. So they're operating under the assumption that Hickok and an accomplice must have pulled this off thinking that there was money in this house.
Yes.
Now, like I said, at first, when they were first at the crime scene, they thought maybe it was only one person because the main thing that they found was a bloody shoe print right by Herb's body. And the shoe print was so distinct that you could tell what brand of boot it was. It was cat paw or cat's paw or something like that. It was a very distinctive sole pattern. Now, when they took pictures of the scene, when the pictures were developed, they also noticed that in the dust, like Herb's body was lying on this flattened like cardboard box. And in the dust on this box was another boot print, right. like a different one.
Right. Yeah.
So then they didn't see them with the naked eye, but they just right. saw them in the photographs. They're like, okay, well, this was two guys. And like you said, they were kind of thinking it probably had to be more than one person anyway, because right. they're like, how would you have herded four people from yeah. the house, you know, and shit like that.
Yeah. If you have any kind of training, say in the infantry or law enforcement.
Yeah.
You know, people that don't have any training think, well, if you have a gun, it's like a magical wand. You can control bunches of people with a pistol. No, not at all. Pull a gun on a crowd of people, you got to cover them all.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The ones that are out of eye shot, they're going to run. They're going to jump out windows and run yeah. off. You know, you know, guns aren't magic wands. You know, one man can only do so much.
Yeah.
You need an entire team of guys with guns to control an entire crowd of enemy soldiers or whatever, you know, or, you know, if you're going to make a heist, you need a whole team of guys.
So eventually what ends up happening now, it took them 6 weeks to catch Dick Hickok
yeah.
and his accomplice, who was named Perry Smith. These two guys had also been cellmates at some point in the past at the Kansas State Penitentiary. And Dick Hickok had apparently contacted Perry Smith about this particular crime. He said, this is going to be a big score. It's going to be easy. It's just some yeah. farm family. They've got a safe. Just go in there with a gun.
Yeah.
Now, they actually were planning on killing whoever was there. Because they wanted to, quote unquote, leave no witnesses. So they were actually planning that, even though later on they kind of changed their stories and said, no, we didn't want anyone yeah. to die or anything like that. But they actually had been planning it the whole time. Hickok actually wanted Perry Smith because Perry Smith had told him this story about killing a black man in Las Vegas just cause.
Just cause.
Even though it was a bullshit story.
Of course, he's trying to fucking stop.
Yeah, he was trying to be tough. Like, yeah. you know, they were in prison and
back
stuff like that.
Back in the Wild West days, you know, the guys who were talking about, you know, they were lying about how many Mexicans they killed or how many Indians they killed.
Yeah, so it was yeah. the same kind of thing.
Right,
so
you had to explain, well, why weren't you charged for that?
Right.
Oh, well, you know, they were foreigners, basically. You yeah. know, that's how it was
so
seen.
So Dick Hickok, pretty much, he's like, yeah, I need, you know, he's like, obviously I need an accomplice for this. And he's like, and I want somebody that can just kill people and not worry about it. Because like I said, they were planning on killing the whole family. Now, like I said, it took them 6 weeks to find them because what they did was, you know, after they did the crime, they basically just took off and they kept going around the country. They kept stealing cars. They did all this other stuff. They went pretty much everywhere. They went to Florida, they went to Vegas, they went all over the place. Now, the interesting thing, I mean, they finally did track them down. You know, they kept running out of money. They did end up pawning, I think they went to Mexico at one point, and they ended up pawning the binoculars that they had stolen from the Clutters and the radio and stuff like that. But that money didn't last very long. And they eventually ended up starting to pass hot checks, which was something that both of them had gotten in trouble for before. Neither of them were murderers prior to this. They were mostly petty criminals, theft, robbery, yeah. You know, check, you know, bad checks, stuff like that. But evidently this was supposed to be their big score. They were going to go to Mexico and retire and all that other kind of shit. What ended up happening, like I said, it took them 6 weeks because they were kind of going all over. And this was actually a really lucky break. They were at a post office in Las Vegas. What they had been doing was mailing their possessions because they said, well, we're going to go to Vegas and do some shit and then we're going to go to Mexico or whatever. So they were mailing their possessions, general delivery, Las Vegas, to the post office there, and they were going to go to town and pick it up. Now, while they were parked at the Las Vegas post office, someone saw them and recognized, because their fucking faces were plastered all over the news. Yeah. And Dick Hickok, particularly, is very recognizable because he was in a car accident in 1950 in which he got a very horrible head injury. And so his face is a little bit lopsided. Oh, and shit. Like one of his eyes is kind of lopsided. Crooked, so it's not like the kind of face you would forget necessarily. Right. Perry Smith also kind of, he was kind of a dark haired little guy, only 5'4".
Yeah.
Kind of stocky. And, you know, he was kind of more normal looking. But yeah, Dick Hickok looked kind of freaky. Yeah. Because of his car accident. So
his thinking probably wasn't too sound.
Well,
either.
They actually kind of argued that at the trial, but I don't know if I buy that completely. Okay. So somebody at the post office recognizes them as these are the two wanted men for killing this poor family in Kansas. So they call the police and the police come there. Now, as it happened, they had just picked up a package from the post office that had all their possessions in it. And both those pairs of boots that matched those boot prints that the Clutter family were in their trunk.
Yep.
And they said, now, if they had caught them a little bit before that or after that, like after they'd had a chance to get rid of their shit or before they had picked up the shit, it might have gone a little differently.
Right.
But they were able to immediately tie them to the site.
Now, can I back up for a second?
Yeah.
How did two guys actually get control of that family?
What they did at first.
House, or a two-story house with a basement.
What they did at first, I think they came in and they first went to Herb, who was downstairs. Everyone else was upstairs, I think.
So they had him contained.
Yeah. Okay. So they first went to Herb and said, where's the safe? And he said there wasn't one. And he was like, basically, he told them where there was a little bit of cash in the house, maybe like $50, not even.
Right.
And he told them where that was. And he's like, you know, that's it.
And the family upstairs don't know what's going on.
I'm not really sure, because what they did at some point was they kind of they used the guns. They herded them all into the bathroom. And then they were talking about what we're going to do. And then they tied each of them up and separated them. So they, so one, and then one of them would kind of watch over the other ones while
why'd they slit the father's throat?
They're not really. Now, I should say that on the drive back, they were taking the two guys, they were taking Smith and Hickok from Vegas back to Kansas, obviously, to stand trial.
Yeah.
And the two guys both pretty much gave a full confession. They said exactly what happened in the house and everything, although they kind of changed their story a couple times, but they didn't deny it.
Right. It's weird that they slit his throat, though.
Well,
because this guy is how the description, these guys are pussies.
Well, how it kind of went.
Mad at this guy.
And how it kind of went, like, evidently, Hickok was mad because he had gotten Perry Smith on board for the sole purpose of killing these people, because that's what he was going to do. He's like, we're going to rob the place and leave no witnesses. That was the plan. So apparently, Hickok was angry that Smith was hesitating.
Okay.
And so, evidently, in his anger, he's like, well, I'll do it. And he stabbed the guy in the neck.
Okay.
And then the other guy, and now he's like, now it's your turn.
Okay, it's weird.
So that's how they, and then they went around shooting them.
He did it that way. He did it that way to fire him up.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
because I would think that really, look, these guys are pussies, okay?
Yeah.
The easy way out is to strangle them.
Yeah.
With like a rope. Because it's not bloody and it's not as quote-unquote violent.
Yeah.
It's just, but I guess he just used it to motivate the other one.
I think that's what ended up happening, like I said. Now, there have been, they changed their story a couple times. I think Smith actually at first said that Hickok had killed the women and he had killed the men.
Right.
But then later, Perry Smith said, no, I killed all of them just because he said, oh, well, I liked Dick Hickok's family and I didn't want his mom to like think of her son as a murderer. So he took the rap. So who knows? I don't know if the same person pulled the trigger on all of them or if it was two and two or whatever the story was.
Right.
But it didn't really matter because they were both there. So they're both murderers.
Yeah. And shooting tied up people. That's another pussy thing to do.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I'm talking about?
Now, the interesting thing, and they were actually asked this. They said, okay, well, once you went into the house and you saw that there was no safe, there was no money, why didn't you just leave? I mean, you know, or why didn't you wear masks for Christ's sake? So you wouldn't have to kill them or anything like that. And then Hickok admitted that he's like, you know, before we even went on this job, I knew that 16-year-old Nancy Clutter would be in there. And he had intended to rape her.
Yeah.
He's like, I actually was kind of more into the idea of that than even the robbery. I didn't even care that much about the robbery. That's why he hung around.
Right.
But evidently, he was going to do it. And evidently, he made like some really gross.
So in a way, this is kind of a fake robbery. What it really was a rape.
I mean, they were thinking that the money was there and that was their original intention. But he was kind of thinking, oh, bonus.
What's weird. It's weird.
So he didn't really care that the money wasn't there because he was going to do that.
Right. But it's weird for me thinking that if guys were going to rob the place, you don't have to kill him. Like you said, you could just wear a mask.
Yeah.
All right. I think the actual intent was to actually go rape that girl.
Yeah.
And the intent was to kill him.
Because they didn't wear masks, I think that they were intending to kill them from the outset.
For some weird reason.
Well, okay. So Hickok said, and like I said, he evidently said some gross thing like, what did he say? Something like, I want to bust that girl's box out or something like that.
Right,
some gross ass shit like that.
Yeah.
Now, evidently, he was going to do it and then Perry stopped him.
Right.
Evidently, Hickok had a thing for teenage girls. His first wife, Carol, was only 16 when he married her. He was several years older than that. So he actually did admit that later on in prison.
Sounds like what you're dealing with is a guy who's kind of like a fledgling serial rapist / serial killer.
Did sound like that,
And that robbery is the excuse that he's using to get this
the
done.
The weird thing is that Perry Smith came from a real shitty background.
Yeah.
His parents were alcoholics. He was abandoned. He was kind of gone from, you know, orphanages and whatever. And he was kind of mistreated as a kid. Hickok, not so much. They said that his family was very normal. He came from a farm family. You know, they kind of gave him every privilege. But he was kind of not a wild child necessarily, but they said he was real scam people. He was, you know, he's a scammer. And like I said, at the trial, pretty much since they had confessed and, you know, pretty much spilled their guts to the psychiatrist and everything like that about what had happened. So pretty much all their defense could do was try to mitigate, try to not get them the death penalty or whatever, and try to say, you know, they had bad childhoods and stuff like that.
Man, fuck those dudes.
But so basically, like I said, in Perry Smith's case, all they could argue was, he had a terrible childhood and all this other stuff, which he did. Now, they tried to argue that Hickok, his personality had changed after his car accident, which probably was true to an extent, but some of the crimes he committed, petty crimes, like I said, passing bad checks and stuff, happened before the accident. So he was kind of a little criminally inclined before that even happened. Interestingly, Perry Smith had also been in a very bad accident. He was in a motorcycle accident. His legs had been all fucked up. I mean, they showed, I've seen footage of his legs and they were pretty deformed. He could walk, but he was very, it was just constant pain all the time. And there was like huge scars and everything like that. So I thought that was kind of interesting too, that he had also been in an accident. Now he was a Army veteran. He'd been in the Korean War.
Okay.
And they actually, one of his Army buddies came to the trial as a character witness.
Yeah.
You know, to say that he'd been like an okay dude and everything like that. Although he did have rage issues.
Rage issues.
And like I said, he was a petty criminal also and had been in and out of prison. Now, as it turned out, you know, as much as the defense tried to make it seem like, you know, these poor guys and everything like that, I mean, the trial took place in the town where the Clutters, and everybody knew the Clutters. I mean, most of the people on the jury knew them and everything like that. So they were not having it. These were just two guys that had come in there robbing. Like, from their point of view, it's like, you killed four beautiful people for $50.
Right, yeah.
That's it. Like, for nothing. Why did you do that? So took him about half an hour to come back with, like, hang him.
Right.
So
yeah, hang him. Fuck those dudes.
So actually, they were due to be executed only a few months after the trial. But of course, you know, when you get a death sentence, you automatically get all the appeals.
Yeah.
So it actually took about 5 years before they were executed. But they eventually were. So before, I want to talk a little bit about Truman Capote and about In Cold Blood and stuff like that. And then I want to talk about the Walker family murders, because I kind of think, like, these two guys were probably responsible for that shit too, even though they denied it.
Okay. Time for a break?
Yeah, so we're going to take a break right now, and we'll be back in just a minute.
The Unseen Hand, a new exploration of poltergeist phenomena by Jenny Ashford, author of The Rochdale Poltergeist, House of Fire and Whispers, and The Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist. The Unseen Hand is a comprehensive collection of over 100 reported poltergeist cases from the first century to the present day. All the best-known cases are presented, from the Bell Witch to Jeff the Talking Mongoose, from Rosenheim to Tina Resch, from Enfield to the Entity. A large selection of fascinating and lesser-known accounts from all over the world are also included, and all contain testimony from the most eerie and extraordinary events. The Unseen Hand is the ultimate compendium for readers interested in poltergeist disturbances throughout history and the theories behind what causes them. On sale now from Amazon in print, ebook, and audiobook formats. Go to Unseen Hand Book on Facebook and visit www.jennyashford.com for more information.
The Villisca Axe Murders, Hinterkaifeck Farm, the Axe Man of New Orleans, the Cleveland Torso Murder, Who Put Bella in the Witch Oven, the Sodder Children, the Phantom Killer, the Black Dahlia, Somerton. What is it about these unsolved murders that still fascinates us long after the cases have gone cold? Is it simply that we enjoy being able to come up with our own theories about what happened to the unfortunate victims? Or are we intrigued by the terrifying possibility that the killers are still out there somewhere? Take a grisly journey through the blood-soaked avenues of early 20th century crime in the new book, The Faceless Villain, Volume 1, by Jenny Ashford, now available on Amazon. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about In Cold Blood, Truman Capote's classic.
Yeah, this is another one I don't know.
Book.
I'm just going to ride along with you.
And the interesting thing about this, like I said, you know, if any of you have read my book, The Faceless Villain, and this is terrible, this is a terrible thing to have to say, but situations where entire families are massacred are not all that unusual throughout history. I mean, it's happened many times. I think the reason, and, you know, not denigrating the Clutter family at all, but really, I think the only reason that this one has stuck in the public consciousness for so long, and why we're still talking about it today, they're still making documentaries about it today. Like I said, the Sundance one called Cold Blooded was on just last year, just a few months ago. Mm-hmm. But it was actually really good, four parts. So because of Truman Capote's book, this one is kind of has kind of entered the public lexicon and why we still remember it. I read the book many years ago. It is a chilling, horrifying book. It's a classic, kind of the first of its kind, because he was not a journalist. He was not a nonfiction writer. He was a fiction writer generally. He had written Breakfast at Tiffany's and all that kind of stuff. He wanted to do something that was a nonfiction book, but written like a novel.
All right.
Which kind of hadn't really been done. Now, he got interested in this case before the perpetrators were caught. He read something about it in the New York Times, and something about it kind of struck a chord with him. He was also from a very small town in Alabama, so he could kind of relate to the kind of framework where this had happened. And so he went out to Kansas along with the famous Harper Lee, who wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, obviously. She had written it at this point, but it hadn't been published yet. She would later win a Pulitzer Prize. So the two of them had actually grown up together in the same neighborhood. So they went to the town to sort of research. Now, obviously, if any of you know, obviously, if you know who Truman Capote is, he's a very small man. He's very, very gay, very flamboyantly. He has a very feminine, high voice. you know, he's that kind of person. He's so obviously when he first arrived in Kansas and saying, hey, I want to write about this dead farm family in the middle of this tiny little conservative town in Kansas, they were not all that excited about it, not just because he was an outsider, but also because they thought he was kind of a weirdo.
Yeah.
But as it happened, it was probably a good thing that he had brought Harper Lee along, because she was kind of, she's a little bit of a mannish woman also, but she's very, I mean, she was also from a small town in Alabama, very down-homey. So she kind of broke the ice a little bit. So even though a lot of the townsfolk didn't like it at first, he eventually did win most of them over.
Kind
now,
of, you know, it kind of comes to my mind.
What's that?
That famous scene where Oscar Wilde goes to the coal miners and hangs out.
Oh,
with
yeah,
the
yeah,
coal
yeah. It was probably a similar kind of thing. Right. It was probably a similar kind of thing.
Yeah, he was like entering an entirely different world.
Yeah. The interesting thing, though, about Truman Capote, he actually, I mean, he was back and forth in Kansas for, it took him a very long time to write the book, because he's like, well, I don't want the book to be finished until it's completed. So since he knew that Perry Smith and Dick Hickok were going to be executed, he's like, well, I can't finish the book until they're executed.
Right.
So he had to wait like 5 years to finish. Right. So the book didn't really come out. It came out in the New York Times first in parts in 1965, and then the book came out in 1966. The weird thing is that he befriended Al Dewey and his family. Al Dewey was the main investigator in the Clutter murder. So him and Al Dewey became very close friends. He also, interestingly, befriended Perry Smith, one of the killers. Hmm. He actually befriended both of the killers, but he said Hickok was kind of more aloof. Hmm. Perry Smith, he said, was actually, he was a lot harder to get to know, but he saw a lot of himself in him.
Hmm.
Because I guess because of his upbringing and because of his, he had like a lot of inadequacy issues, you know, stemming from him being very short and from his upbringing and stuff like that. So I think he kind of related to him. You know, obviously he still thought it was horrible that he had murdered people, but he found him an intriguing character. And one of the main criticisms, I don't remember thinking this at the time that I read the book, but one of the criticisms is that he humanizes the killers too much. Like he almost tries to make them sympathetic. I didn't really get that.
Right.
But I can see that if you maybe lived in the town and you knew the victims,
you
could feel like, I don't want these people humanized. They're monsters.
You wouldn't dig it.
You wouldn't dig it. And some people didn't. Some townsfolk were fine with it. Some people have also made the claim that he might have exaggerated, or some of the stuff in there wasn't exactly true. He probably took a little bit of literary license, but according to most of the investigators on the case, now one of them said he hasn't even read the book and he just won't. But most of the other investigators were like, you know, most of the book was pretty accurate. He did put in a couple scenes just to kind of massage things into a certain narrative, but he didn't really mess up anything too much. Probably one of the other main criticisms was that he made Bonnie Mae Clutter, the matriarch of the family, kind of seem like, quote unquote, a ghost of a person, like she suffered from depression and stuff, which she did. But pretty much everybody that knew her was like, you know, she wasn't just laying around in bed, woe is me, all the time. Yeah. She was, you know, she was pretty much a vibrant woman. She did have problems with depression, but she, you know, led a normal life and it didn't really affect her all that greatly, or as greatly as it said in the book. Now, Truman Capote, he had been writing back and forth as the killers the whole time they were on death row, and he actually went to the execution. So he saw them hung.
Damn.
And he said he did cry, because he had kind of befriended them, like, you know, they were people to him, but he felt like he needed to be there. Interestingly, and really probably he himself has said this too, In Cold Blood was the last book that Truman Capote was able to complete. After In Cold Blood came out, and it was a huge success, he made millions of dollars off it, you know, and everything like that. But after that, he kind of went into a downward spiral of alcoholism and drug use and everything
like that.
Depressed
him too much, huh?
Yeah, he just, it really affected him a lot.
Right.
And really, it was only, I think it was only less than 20 years later, he was dead.
Wow.
And he had never completed another book after that.
So it's that last 20 years that kills you.
I guess it must be. And like I said, if you look, there's still on YouTube and in various documentaries, there is footage of Truman Capote on various talk shows, you know, later on in his life, talking about the book and how it kind of ruined his life, sort of. You know, and on a couple of them, he's obviously just shit-faced, drunk. And you know what I mean? So, you know, that kind of a shitty thing. But You know, I really liked the book. I thought it was very compelling. The movie they made about it in 1967, I believe the movie came out, black and white, Robert Blake played Perry Smith.
Yeah.
And Scott Wilson played Dick Hickok. And if you don't know, for all you youngsters, he's the guy that played Herschel on Walking Dead.
Yeah.
So this is him when he was very young. And the movie is terrifying. I found it terrifying. Probably one of the scariest movies I've ever seen. Just very, because it's very, I don't want to say documentary-like, but it is very matter-of-fact. The way they film it is very matter-of-fact. And they're just going around this house shooting these poor people. And, you know, it's just kind of horrifying. But watching Cold Blooded, the documentary, where they actually talk to a lot of the family members, the two surviving Clutter daughters actually did talk on camera, but they didn't want to be seen on camera. And you can kind of feel the vibe of the townspeople and the family members. I mean, basically, the two daughters, they changed their names like soon after that because they said they didn't want to be associated. They're like, pretty much people are still talking about this case now. That's pretty much all this town is known for, you know, and it's never going to go away. And in a way, they're kind of like, we wish we could just move past it, but we can't because of that book, you know, and people are still talking about it. So I can kind of feel where they're coming from. You know, they just kind of wish they could have normal lives instead of having all these people tramping through here talking about this book still. Okay, so now that I've kind of covered that, I want to cover this other murder because I feel like this one sort of gets short shrift and I feel like it might have been the same dudes.
Okay.
Maybe not, but I kind of feel like it was. So this happened about a little bit more than a month after the Clutter family. This happened in Osprey, Florida, which is near Sarasota. Now, it was a Saturday. There was Cliff and Christine Walker, young couple in their 20s. They had two little kids, Jimmy, who was 3, and Debbie, who was 1. They had been out getting a Christmas tree, doing Christmas shit. You know, it was December 19th. So they had been out running errands and stuff, and they decide they're going to drop by and see their friends, Don and Lucy McLeod. So they're at the McLeod house. Now, Cliff and Don McLeod, they're planning on going on a hunting trip the next day, which is Sunday. But they're like, well, today, this afternoon, we'll go out and hunt a little bit, and it'll be fun, and then the women and the children can stay back here and talk or whatever. So they kind of do that. Then later on, the Walkers actually headed back to their house in two separate cars because Cliff is driving the kids in the Jeep because it has all this cattle feed in it that Don McLeod had given him. So Christine says, well, I'll drive our car back to the house, you know, and we'll go separate. So she starts driving back to the house and Cliff says, okay, I'll just be like 10, 15 minutes behind you. Now she gets back to the house and evidently someone was already there. I don't know if they were in the house or if they were waiting in the driveway or what.
Now, what's the environment? Is this a suburban place? Is it a country house?
It was kind of a country house. Okay. The house is actually not there anymore. I do have a couple pictures of it from the time. It just looks like a regular old Florida house from the 50s.
So that means it had houses on either side of it.
It didn't.
They had neighbors.
It's hard to tell
from the
photos.
Okay.
It could be that it was kind of like a farm. And there was, like I said, the house isn't there anymore because I've seen the lot and it's been torn down.
Sounds like she walked in on burglars.
Well, no, that's not what happened because they think whoever it was, she must have either known them or not had any reason to fear them because they said she went in the house and started putting groceries away. And she even put up like Lucy McLeod had given her a Christmas card earlier that day. And she even kind of displayed it and stuff like that. So obviously whoever this was didn't just like jump on her.
Could it have been that she was unpacking groceries, going out to the car and the door was open and somebody saw that and walked in?
Could have been.
Because you know how it is when you're unloading the car from the groceries, you know?
Yeah, it could have been that as well. Basically what happens, she gets raped and murdered.
Right. The kids were
now,
not with her. Right.
Well, they were coming later. Now, the husband and the kids were in the Jeep.
Right.
They pull up, come in the house, evidently interrupted the rape and murder of Christine, and they all got shot too.
Okay.
Now, here's the creepiest thing. The dad, Cliff, he's in the corner. He was obviously trying to protect his son when he got shot. The son was still holding like an empty lollipop stick.
Oh, man.
He got shot in the head. The baby, who was only one, Debbie, she was shot in the top of the head. And evidently that didn't kill her because then the killer took her in the bathroom and drowned her in the tub.
Do we know what the weapon was? Anything like that?
It's .22. It was a .22 caliber handgun.
Right, because I was thinking, man, you shoot a baby in the top of the head with a 9mm or a .45.
Yeah.
That head would just vaporize.
Yeah.
So I knew it was something small.
So the bodies were not found until the next day. I mean, obviously, Don McLeod, the friend, he had been coming over to pick up Cliff for their hunting trip that morning. And he was like, why isn't anybody awake? So he goes in the house. The first thing he thought, because no one answered and the house was dark, he's like, oh, it must have been carbon monoxide gas and everyone's unconscious in there. That was the first thing he thought.
Right.
So he walks in the house because obviously it wasn't locked. And he sees Christine laying all bloody, and then he sees Cliff and Jimmy in the corner, and they're obviously dead. So he obviously they had no cell phones in 1959. So he runs to he drives to the nearest payphone and calls the police. Now, at first, as they always do, they're like, well, maybe this is somebody that had a particular beef with this family. Right. Now, there were a few things taken from the house. But again, just like in the Clutter case, it wasn't anything particularly valuable. And some of it was weird. Like there was a little bit of cash taken. Okay. It's just like some petty little amount.
Yeah.
The only other things that were taken were the Walkers had a marriage certificate that was framed and hung on their wall. That was gone. Cliff had a pocket knife. That was taken.
Took the marriage certificate?
Yeah. And Christine's majorette uniform from high school, which was in a cedar chest in their bedroom.
Some kind of sexual killer.
So, well, that's what they thought at first, because it didn't look like robbery had been the motive necessarily, because there wasn't anything particularly valuable taken.
Yeah, it looks like
he's taking personal items.
Fetish items and
right. Yeah. So they thought, well, maybe that's what it was. Maybe it was somebody that knew Christine or had a thing for her.
Maybe went to high school with her when she was a cheerleader.
Yeah, maybe. Like it might have been something like that. So all they found at the scene, they found part of a pack of cigarettes, a bloody cowboy boot, of all things. They found a fingerprint on one of the faucets of the bathtub where he had drowned the baby. So, like I said, at first they're kind of thinking, okay, well, this is probably somebody who lived in the area and knew them, because they said whoever came to the door. Now, it should be noted that Christine usually parked the family car in a specific spot in front of the house. Mm-hmm. When the bodies were found the next day, her car was parked somewhere else, which suggested that someone else was parked in that spot.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently this did not immediately alarm her. So they're kind of thinking maybe she knew who it was, or maybe it was somebody that they got out of the car and hailed her or something like that. And she went in and was putting away groceries and stuff. So they're thinking, well, maybe it was somebody that knew her. So the first person, oh, and they also thought that it was weird that the children were killed. They said maybe that was somebody that did know the family and they killed the children because they were afraid they would be identified. Like one of the kids.
Yeah, why the baby?
Right. Yeah.
Wouldn't matter if the baby died or not.
Yeah, that's what I mean. They also, later on, they found some bloody clothing that had been used to kind of clean up the scene. They found out in a shed near the property. So they said maybe this was somebody that knew the area. So one of the first suspects they had along this line, somebody that apparently knew them, was a guy named Curtis McCall. He was 21. And there had been a rumor going around that he'd been having an affair with Christine, although nobody else seemed to. I mean, a couple people thought that, but most people thought that that wasn't the case. Mm-hmm. And he denied it also. He did have kind of a history of violent behavior. He did own a .22 caliber handgun, although he said he had sold it a long time ago and that he didn't have it anymore. They gave him some polygraph tests. The results were inconclusive, so they weren't really sure if it was that guy or not. There was also another guy who was like an old man, and his name was Wilbur Tooker. And evidently, he was kind of an old lech, and he had made some passes at Christine in the past, and Cliff had told him to fuck off. So they kind of considered him maybe, but they kind of later got cleared because there was no evidence. Also a family member, I believe that it was Cliff's cousin, Albert. And the reason they started to suspect him was that at the Walker family funeral, he was acting very weird, like, and they thought he was acting suspicious. So they kind of took him in for questioning, but they couldn't find any evidence against him either. But then, and this even happened at the time, when the Walkers were killed, they were like, this looks kind of similar to the Clutter family murders. And there were a lot of similarities. Now, it is known that Hickok and Smith, after they killed the Clutters, this was about a month and 4 days later that the Walkers died from the Clutter murders. After they'd killed the Clutters, they went on the run. They went all over the place. Now, around the time that the Walkers were murdered, Smith and Hickok were in Florida. They had stayed at a hotel in Miami a couple days before. And actually, they had been seen in a store in Sarasota on the day of the murders. So they were provably in the area. Several witnesses did place them in the area of the murders at the time of the murders. Interestingly, also, the car they were driving, which was stolen, was a Chevrolet Bel Air. Now, the Walker family, on the Saturday before they were killed, they had actually been thinking about buying a Chevrolet Bel Air and had been test driving some cars that morning. So investigators speculated, they're like, well, maybe Smith and Hickok rolled up in this Chevy Bel Air and said they wanted to sell it. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, so maybe that's how they got in.
Right.
So, you know, that was just speculation, but they just thought it was interesting that it was the same type of car.
Yeah, I think it's just speculation.
Now, interestingly also is that when Smith and Hickok were captured in Las Vegas, among their possessions in their car where they were found was a pocket knife, very much like the one that was taken from the Walker house.
Uh-huh.
There were also like a baby booty.
Yeah.
And like a little baby shirt.
Yeah.
Found in their trunk, I believe. So
how did they explain it?
That seemed a little weird.
How did they explain that?
See, they just denied it altogether.
But did they find the majorette's uniform?
They did not. The thing, now, I didn't actually, when I was writing the bit about the Walker family for my book, The Faceless Villain, I didn't actually know that Hickok had a thing for teenage girls. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, well, him having a thing for teenage girls, because like I said, Christine Walker was raped.
Right.
She wasn't a teenager, but she wasn't very old. She was only in her early 20s. So I'm kind of thinking that Hickok finally got to rape somebody because he'd wanted to rape Nancy Clutter, mm-hmm. as by his own admission, and hadn't been able to. Maybe that's why he took the majorette uniform.
I don't know.
Seems weird that they would take the marriage certificate, though.
Now, back up again. How was she killed? Gunshot wound?
Yeah.
Just one?
Twice.
Twice.
She was shot twice.
And does it say where? Headshots, probably?
Probably headshots.
Yeah.
Cliff was shot once in the face.
Yeah, 22 is not a very destructive...
And the three-year-old kid was shot three times in the head.
Yeah.
So
22 is not a very destructive cartridge. It's kind of like an ice pick wound.
Yeah. Another thing, too, that I forgot to mention, that they thought that once the attack had started to happen, that Christine had started, like, fighting like hell, because they found one of her high-heeled shoes out on the porch, and it had blood all over the heel, as though she had taken it off and tried to beat the shit out of him and then got dragged back into the house. So because there were many similarities, you know, it's the same kind of thing where it's like they broke in the house, the woman was raped, they were all shot.
But were they shot by the same caliber, though? See, that was the thing.
No, because in the Clutter murder, it was a 12-gauge shotgun.
Right. See, if you ask me, I think all crime scenes are going to kind of look the same.
Right. But it does seem interesting to me that Smith and Hickok happened to be right there when this happened.
Yeah.
That seems a little coincidental to me.
Whatever it was a crime of opportunity. I think either one or two people was already in the house when she came in. They watched her unload the groceries for a while. They were either in the house or they were outside the house watching it. They saw her.
I'm kind of wondering about the car, though, because like I said, her car was parked in a different spot, which says to me that probably there was another car parked in her regular spot.
Well, maybe it was a Bel Air, and it was parked there, and she thought that maybe her husband would had bought the gift, or, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's true.
There's the Bel Air we were thinking of, and she goes in there, and she's like, she doesn't know there's anybody in there, and she's unloading the groceries, and then they pop out and grab her. You don't know.
But it could have been. Now, even at the time in 1959,
I tend to think that's kind of complicated, if you ask me. I think probably what happened is somebody saw her. They were probably outside the house and saw her go in. Followed her in and did it.
Yeah.
And then she's probably saying, my husband's on his way type of deal, and they don't believe her.
Yeah.
Or the guy doesn't believe her.
Yeah, because the husband and kids turned up maybe 10, 15 minutes
later. Right. And, you know, he's thinking she's just trying to talk her way out of it.
Right.
And they do show up and he shoots him.
Yeah. Yeah, because it did look like they pretty much shot him as soon as he walked in the door. The son and the dad.
Well, he had probably already killed the woman and was probably rummaging through the house. And he hears the car pull up. And it's like, oh, shit. And then he gets into position and ambushes them when they walk in. Something like that.
Yeah, probably is what happened. Now, at the time when Smith and Hickok were in custody for the Clutter murders, like I said, they did think even back then that there was probably some association because they did know that they were in the Sarasota area on the day of this murder. And they gave them a polygraph test and they asked them about this. Now, both of them denied it. The polygraph test seemed to say they were telling the truth, but polygraphs are, you know, even nowadays are notoriously unreliable. And in 1959, infinitely more so. So they didn't really think that could rule them out. Now, because they are still trying to solve the Walker murders, in 2012, they actually had the bodies of Smith and Hickok exhumed. So they could get DNA because they had had DNA from Christine's pants.
Okay.
And they wanted to match it. Unfortunately, the DNA was too degraded and the results were inconclusive. So they said, we can't rule them in, but we can't rule them out. So it's still possible that they could have done it.
I got a gut feeling that it's just another random loser. All right.
Yeah, and it might have been. It very well might have been someone who knew her. I mean, like I said, the majorette uniform... Okay, Hickok might have taken that because he had a teenager thing.
Right.
But the marriage certificate, why would you take someone's marriage certificate?
It sounds like some kind of a weird
You can't
weird
hawk
fetishy,
that. You can't, yeah.
Sounds like some kind of weird
So in a way, I don't know.
Killer.
I kind of lean toward maybe Smith and Hickok did this. There's a lot of coincidences, and I think it's like a coincidence. Oh, you know, they were in the same area when this very similar murder happened. That seems a little too much like, But like you said, there are aspects that almost kind of make it seem, like you said, fetishistic or someone who was stalking her or knew her.
From school.
Because that seems to jibe more with taking the marriage certificate. Maybe they were jealous or something like that. So I don't know. It could go either way.
Yeah.
But I do think that there is a lot of researchers do think that probably Smith and Hickok might have done this too. But like I said, unless they get better DNA, I mean, the two guys are dead, so it's like they're never going to know. They did deny it. They said they didn't have anything to do with it. I guess until they get some better evidence, they're never going to know if that happened or until they catch someone else for doing
it. I just got a feeling that's a random loser she went to school with, something like that.
Yeah, it might have been.
Yeah.
All right, so that'll do it for this another extra long episode. That's okay.
Long.
Well, you know, they go on long sometimes, and I don't really like to like rush it if I'm not done talking.
I understand. It's still a good show.
Yeah. So remember, if you like the show, please like, share, subscribe, and share with all your friends. Share on all your social media. Help us out. Get us some more subscribers. That would be awesome. If you'd like to support the show financially, you can check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/13o'clock or go to our blog at 13o'clockpodcast.wordpress.com. And there's a link in the sidebar to a PayPal account where you can make a one-time donation if you would like to do that. Also, check out our Zazzle store at zazzle.com/13o'clock. We have several shirts and a tote bag that you can purchase if you so desire. Also, check out our latest movie review, which was Roman Polanski's The Tenant, if you haven't watched it yet. Check out my new book, The Faceless Villain, which actually has a section on the Walker family murder, not the Clutter one, because obviously that was solved. But the Walker family one is still unsolved, so that was in there. So if you haven't read that, then go check it out. The second volume should be out sometime in the next few months, and I will let everybody know when that comes out. And that will do it for episode 85, and we will see you next time. Bye. Killing me. Yeah, it's killing me. Yeah, you're killing me. In cold blood. Save you from yourself and these four walls in Holcomb to keep you from the sun. And now we're faced with two wrongs. Now we're faced with two wrongs. I don't know. Oh, I don't know. And now we're faced with two wrongs. Now we're faced with two wrongs. I don't know. Oh, I don't know.